Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Generating billions of dollars in profit each year, human trafficking is one of the world's fastest-growing criminal activities. Unlike the trade in drugs and weapons, those who traffic in humans can sell and resell their commodity, forcing each victim to suffer repeatedly. To learn more about human trafficking, I went to Portland to talk with Detective Keith Bickford at the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Detective Bickford heads the Oregon Foreign-Born Human Trafficking Task Force, and he began by defining the crime.
It's modern-day slavery. It's taking a vulnerable population of people and through force, fraud, or coercion, you know, making them do something that usually the trafficker makes money off of, some sort of exploitation. Mm-hmm. It could be, you know, the sex trafficking, it could be labor trafficking, there is no population. I say vulnerable, but I'm kind of seeing now that there's really no population that can be exempt from it either. So
am I understanding there's sort of two basic forms it takes, people who are sort of enslaved for their labor, mm-hmm. and then people who are enslaved for sexual purposes? Are those the primary two?
Yes, I'd say that.
Who are the people who are doing this? Who are the traffickers?
It could be anybody, you know, male or female traffickers. There was a pimp, a young pimp, 15 years old, that had his own business and ran it like a seasoned veteran. Mm-hmm. So it can be just about anyone.
I guess what you're saying surprises me a little, because I think the picture in my mind, at least, and maybe in the minds of others, is that the traffickers are organized crime or gangs or so on. But you mentioned that it could be individuals.
Mm-hmm. It can be individuals. It could be family members. I've had several people brought up here from Central America. They were brought up by a cousin or a mom or, you know, a dad, and then trafficked. So it could be just about anybody.
And the motive would always be to make money from this person in some way, either from their labor or from the sexual services that they provide and so on.
Exactly.
It's not that visible. How do the traffickers keep this hidden?
Well, for the longest time, let me give you a perfect example of kind of why it's we are where we are right now. In 2005, there was a huge federal grant floating around the state of Oregon, and nobody picked up that grant to start a trafficking unit because nobody thought they had a trafficking problem.
Right.
So. The county did pick it up. We did start up a trafficking unit, which is actually just one person. But, we started sniffing around and started, you know, finding out that there was trafficking issues. But I think it was just that people weren't educated, didn't know what to look for. And with trafficking, you can hide in plain sight. If you're talking about labor, say like a domestic trafficking victim working in somebody's house as a maid, that's kind of a normal thing. You know, people do have maids, or they do have nannies. They do have people working for them. And if this person is not showing signs of abuse of some kind, people really aren't going to notice it. The same thing with the other side of it, the pimps or the Johns. That's been a hidden cancer for a long, long time. They've just been able to hide it through great communication. The understanding of how to avoid the police, how to avoid detection, period. They've been able to hide in the darkness. And it's because of people like you and because of people like the different communities that I've talked to that people are starting to open their eyes a little bit and know what to look for and now know what to do once they see something that, you know, could be a problem.
You mentioned pimps and Johns, and I want to ask, in your experience, in your estimation, what percentage of prostitutes are there who actually are doing it willingly, who aren't being coerced or forced? Or
I personally, I want to say none of them.
Hmm.
Because in my mind, it's hard to imagine being treated that way over and over and over again. When I started this kind of thing, one of the big deals to me was, you know, we had these children under the age of 18, boys and girls both, who are, you know, have a pimp. They're getting raped, you know, 10 to 15 times a day by different men, treated horribly, beaten. You know, these Jones do whatever they want to these kids. That, you know, that, of course, that lifestyle just sounds, you know, horrible. It's like a nightmare. But then, you know, when these kids turn 18, they age out, and they aren't considered to be, you know, victims of human trafficking, because if you're under the age of 18, you're automatically a victim of trafficking if there's [S2] Right. [S1] Any kind of sexual exploitation. You already knew that. Over 18, for some reason, the system thought, well, you know, they're 18 now. They can make a great – they're going to make decisions. And the decision is to either get out of this or to continue with it. That's not the way it works. They're in it, and they're in it because they can't get out of it. There's a reason behind it. There's extortion or coercion. There's maybe some form of fraud. There's something where they can't get out of that situation.
Well, can you expand on that a little bit? How is it that the traffickers control people? Because I think, you know, some people would say, well, you know, they could get away, or they could walk away, or they could do this, or they could do that, and that's not really true. Explain what the traffickers do. How do they control people?
And that's a great question, because we live in a free society where we can make decisions and walk away from something if we don't like it, or we're not treated correctly, or we can call the Department of Labor, call the police, whatever. You know, that we have those rights. These folks are deliberately picked a lot of times because they may not understand the system, or they may not just have the abilities to understand that they have human rights. Children, for example, can be coerced very easily. I could walk up to a child, probably a runaway homeless youth, for example, and say, you know what, it's the middle of winter, it's freezing outside, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a roof over your head and food if you come work for me, and make money, and then explain the situation. You know, sleep with these guys, here's the business I have, this, I will get you new clothes, I'll take care of you, because your parents obviously don't want to take care of you, don't love you. Okay, so that they catch them at a very vulnerable time. So that person comes and starts working with them. It could be another way too. There could be, you know, they could pretend to be the boyfriend, and started getting into a sexual relationship with this child. Take some pictures, and then use those pictures as a blackmail to say, you either come work for me, or I'm going to send these pictures to your church, to your school, to your parents. There could also be another big one is threatening family. Mm-hmm. You come work for me, or I go kill your little brother. Mm-hmm. And I know what school he goes to. I know what time where, you know, how his walking route to and from school, all sorts of different things. You know, kill your family, hurt your family, anything like that. Now, on the other side of the world, in the international part of it, for those type of people, same kind of thing. There's a lot of connections in Mexico with cartels. The cartel, you know, individual or representative would go to a town or a village, find people that they may be familiar with and know with a family, and say, yeah, hey, I got a great job for you up in the United States. Come on up. Get them up here. If you don't do what I tell you to do, I'm either going to call immigration and they'll come get you, or we'll have someone go kill your family. And that's a horrible thing when you think about it. They're clear up here in the United States, and their family's way back in Oaxaca, Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just, it's difficult. So a lot of it I've noticed has been that mind game, that coercion. You know, a long time ago, beatings were very popular, especially in the pimp world, the gorilla pimp. Mm-hmm. Basically just known to beat the girls, you know, and that's how he kept them in line. But the pimps start to notice that the girls wear out faster when they're beaten. They don't look as good, so they're not making a lot of money. Mm. So they stopped doing that and started going more towards the mental game and getting a hold on them that way.
Well, I'll kill your family is a pretty strong threat.
That would work for
somebody who's in. Sure, sure. Is there any way to sort of typify who the victims are or where they come from, or is that as broad as the number the kind of traffickers?
It's just as broad, to be honest with you. We used to think that the runaway homeless youth population was kind of the only group that the pimps would kind of hunt down, but they've expanded. There's been a couple of young women that have been missing in, just in this Tri-County area. That hooked up with a pimp, supposedly, and one of the girls was a 4-point student, had a job, had her own car, you know, both parents were pillars in the community, and she disappeared with this guy and haven't seen her since. Mm-hmm. So once again, I want to break out that whole, you know, runaway homeless youth, that's not the only group. You know, on the other side, too, the international side, we do see people that are very vulnerable from different countries, third world countries, where they're illiterate in their own language. But we are seeing people now that can speak English too, and are semi-educated, that are getting stuck in this. The traffickers are becoming better and better trained and prepared to handle any type of person. So they could go down to a village that's about ready to be attacked by guerrillas, you know, that are moving through their particular state or country, and they can manipulate them and say, you know, we can get you out of here and take care of you, come up to the States and work. That's an easy one. Mm-hmm. But they can also go now to business owners and say, hey, you know what? You have a great talent here in Mexico or Guatemala, and why don't you come up to the United States and work for us? And put those business talents to work. So they bring them up, you know, this is a well-educated person who's running their own business and doing really well, and they can even get, you know, tricked into this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is an international problem. It's worldwide.
Exactly.
It's happening in countries all over. If we narrow in on Oregon for a moment, what kinds of problems are predominant here? What are you seeing the most of?
Well, of course, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the child sex trafficking in Portland. Mm-hmm. That follows the I-5 corridor. So if you go from Seattle all the way down to Medford, there's going to be activity all through the larger cities and some of the smaller ones, too. I-84 is another artery that's a good one for both pimps and for, you know, international traffickers. So because it's been hidden so well, that domestic trafficking or the child sex trafficking has been going on for a long time. It's got a good business. It's got supply. It's got demand. It's going well. The pimps communicate well with each other. The Johns communicate well with each other, and so do the young children involved in the sex trafficking. So they have a good business going. Alongside of that, in Oregon, we have huge agricultural and farming communities, enormous, and nowadays, there's probably 10 months of work that these people can have from the beginning of the season, preparing the actual season itself, and then cleaning up afterwards. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of work there. And so a lot of people are coming up here. I've interviewed people from, you know, Central America that have actually didn't say they were coming to the United States. They were saying they're coming to Oregon to work. Hmm. Some of them were coming to Woodburn to work or Salem. So, you know, Oregon is a targeted state, and you know, without sounding disrespectful to our you know, politicians and lawmakers, we had some pretty weak laws for a while too, mm-hmm. and we're starting to catch that up as well. So, you know, we're wedged in between Washington and California, who have very strong trafficking laws. Oregon's catching up, and we have a lot of people working very hard to get us up into the same categories as California and Washington, because we don't want to be stuck in the middle and have weak laws and have everybody coming our way. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to adapt and become a stronger, you know, state in the ways of the laws and things like that, and training, you know, for police and victim specialists. So it's all getting better and better, but, you know, it was just hidden for so long and so many people involved that it's going to take us a long time to just to make a dent in this problem.
Is, you mentioned being on the corridors and so on, and that bringing a lot of trafficking into and through Portland. Does it follow then that there is less in rural areas, or it's a different kind of trafficking in rural areas, or what's your take on that?
The rural areas could be a lot more the labor camps and things like mm-hmm. that. You know, that's not uncommon. But it also isn't uncommon for a pimp to leave the bigger city and go to a rural area where there's maybe less law enforcement or something like that and start a business there. So I wouldn't say there's probably a little bit of difference, but not much. And once again, I don't want people to kind of think that because we live out in the country, we're okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one change in the law that's come about, I guess nationally, is that police aren't treating prostitutes the same way they used to. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That is actually, been a huge step. Mm-hmm. It's nice to be able to actually go away from the word prostitute and call them a victim mm-hmm. or a trafficking victim. Because we have to understand that they probably started very early in their life in this world. And as I indicated, just because you turn 18 doesn't mean that you're just going to go, oh, wow, I need to get out and leave.
Or that
you'd be allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And pimps, you know, they trade women. They sell them to each other. If one ages out, you know, there may be a pimp that likes, you know, older women to be in his herd versus like the younger girls. So there may be a trade or whatever, but there's still a hold on these women and men that are involved in sex trafficking. And I like the idea, like you said, they're eliminating the prostitution, word, that's a terrible word, and we're starting to treat them all like victims and try our best to help them.
Mm-hmm. I know, too, that I guess maybe you could explain why trafficking is such a difficult thing to get our arms around, to control. You touched on some of those things, but it's hidden, for one thing. What are some of the other difficulties that are faced?
Trying to get the victims and to keep the victims is very hard. You know, that's a victim and a witness at the same time to build a case. Usually if you don't have that victim, you don't really have the case anymore. Because of that force, fraud, coercion, especially the coercive part of it, the mental manipulation, a lot of times the victim wants to go back to the trafficker because that's all they know,
mm-hmm.
or they're because they're so scared they're not going to talk or they're not going to tell their story.
So I guess the way that comes out then is when you first encounter a victim, they may not be very forthcoming about
exactly
their situation.
It takes a lot of work to chip away and get to the core of the problem. Absolutely. You know, the law enforcement, victim specialists, they're all getting better and better at doing that. But the key to that is getting everybody to work together. When I started this, we had some issues with the feds not necessarily working with state and local law enforcement. Law enforcement not necessarily wanting to work with victim specialists and the other way around. There wasn't a lot of trust. That's changing now. The U.S. Attorney's Office has taken this here in Portland. We actually have a U.S. attorney assigned to a domestic trafficking task force and then one assigned to international trafficking. And they're taking the reins, and they are, I wouldn't say forcing, but they are making sure that when we have meetings, the door is open, that victim specialists come in, talk to law enforcement, sit around the table, and work together. And it's amazing to me, and I think it's going to get better in the international world, but in the domestic world right now, like the Portland police, for example, if they have a young girl that they believe is a child sex trafficking victim, they automatically call victim specialists out to the case also,
mm-hmm.
or out to the incident area. So, I mean, that's one of their policies now. And to me, that's an enormous step for law enforcement to accept the fact that we can't take this on our own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a type A personality. Most of us do. We handle things. We take care of things on our own. You know, that's the way we work, and that's the way we're trained.
Sure.
You know, we have to throw all that training out the window and start over again. We have to understand that the community, that the faith-based communities, the victim specialists, the victims, everybody has to work together and communicate, trust, talk, And that's the only way we're going to beat this.
It's got to be really helpful then when somebody who has been a victim and escapes that comes and does the other side of that and tries to help other victims because there's trust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some of the countries that the people come from, the police may be part of the problem, and so they have no reason to trust the police, or they've been told by their trafficker that the police are out to get them and so on, so they don't trust you at first sight.
Exactly, and I don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a hard thing for a cop to swallow. You know, here in the United States, you usually show up and people are, for the most part, if they're good, want to see you.
Mm-hmm.
These folks are scared of everything. You know, whether it's a trafficker telling them things or just word of mouth talking about what immigration does to people, how they disappear. And like you said, which is a really good point, they're coming from a country where law enforcement is part of the, you know, they're corrupt. There could be traffickers there, the military.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of third world countries, those people go to a hospital to die. We go to get better,
mm-hmm.
or we at least hope we get better.
Mm-hmm.
They go to die in some of their countries, or mm-hmm. you know, there's no such thing as a dentist. There's no such thing as victim specialists. So there's a lot of things that are very foreign to them that they don't understand. So it does take a lot of work and a lot of really good patient people to get these folks to come out and talk. And I tell you, the one big thing about my job is if they come out to talk, especially foreign-born trafficking victims, you tell them, you know, you can come out and talk, you'll be okay, we'll take care of you. You better take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
If you drop the ball once, you could lose that person, and that person's going to go back to their community, and you could lose that whole community.
Well, and there still can that be that thing hanging over them about how the trafficker said they would kill their family or
mm-hmm.
kill their children or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on these
awful.
People. Yeah, it's awful. And like I said, I understand it now, and I know that they're, you know, even though they may have an immigration attorney or a victim specialist helping them out, this is folks from other countries, you know, they still come in and they're shaking and they're scared I totally get it now. I understand that I have a lot of work to do before there's any kind of trust. I have to prove myself, and you know, that's something we're not accustomed to either as law
mm-hmm.
enforcement.
Sure,
you know, we're
sure.
supposed
You're
to be the Superman,
right.
you know, the fixes everything. And,
well, and you expect the uniform to sort of say to everybody, "This is who I am, and I'm
exactly.
here to protect you," and so on. And it may not say that to someone else.
Yeah, it could be a very scary thing. So. There's a lot of things I have to do before, you know, I expect people to trust me and expect communities to trust me.
Is there kind of a network building up of services and so on to help someone who finally does escape from that web and you know, a victim who comes out who may be from another country, may be worried about being deported, or, you know, may have been told all these stories or may fear for their relatives?
It's been a lot easier for the U.S. citizen victims.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had things in place that weren't necessarily used. You had to dust them off and bring them out into the you know, out of the closet and engage them, you know, to take care of the victims. On the other side of that, we're developing the foreign-born side right now. I work with immigration attorneys that are really, really dedicated to this. The National Crime Victims Law Institute's very dedicated to this. Like I said, the U.S. attorney. We have ICE agents now, both sides of ICE, the Homeland Security Investigation, and then the Enforcement Removal Operations. Those people are coming out of their offices now and attending meetings and getting more involved and understanding that they have to be in person. They have to show up. They have to be involved. They have to communicate and talk. You know, they can't just do things from their office like that they used to. So we're making some huge strides with the understanding. Like I said, we have to work together. We have to communicate, but we also have to understand what type of person is sitting across from us when we're interviewing them. We can't have a list of questions and say da 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 and write it down and think that that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of women that I've talked to from different countries that part of their culture is if the man comes home from work or comes home from a bad day, he's allowed to slap the woman
right.
around.
Right.
And so if I say, "Did your husband assault you?" No, you know, everything's pretty much okay.
Sure.
So you have to kind of redirect and really, you know, chip away a little bit before you understand that, yeah, that's a normal part of my life. you know, I'm used to that, or I'm used to them branding me, or, you know, there's some things that I've just accepted. And so, and it's been a learning experience for all of us. You know, I thought I had maybe a kind of a good grasp on interviewing techniques, but that got thrown in my face the first day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, what do you wish for at this point? You've been doing this for a while. What would help you do a better job of getting after this crime?
The law enforcement working together, the victim specialists, you know, working together, that kind of teamwork is always good. But the community,
mm-hmm.
the understanding from an international point of view that there are folks that are up here that are undocumented, that doesn't mean they're breaking the law or bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to be a little bit more understanding and look beneath the surface a little bit and maybe try to help these folks, because I guarantee you most of them are going to have a story that you weren't aware of and that they're not really willing to share.
Mm-hmm.
And helping them and being a little bit more understanding and patient. And then on the other side of that too, with the communication, there also should be outreach and education. Know what to look for, and then know what to do once you find it.
Well, give us some help with that right now. The average person, are there things that they might notice or things that they might be aware of that would help them recognize a situation of trafficking? And what would they do if they did? Well, if they suspected something like that?
And that's a good question, but it's a tough one to answer. For example, one woman, I sent an electronic packet out to her that had a whole lot of trafficking information on it. She read through it. She noticed across the street that there was a lot of activity, a lot of cars going in and out, but late at night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could, you know, that could be just an active nightlife.
Right.
Or it could be drug issues or other criminal activity. But the one thing that she noticed was there were several younger Asian girls being escorted in and out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time they had like a jacket over their head or something, and some guy was holding them, controlling them, getting them into a car, and then they took off. So she called me, gave me the address. I ran the address, and guess what? That house is actually being watched by, law enforcement right now,
mm-hmm.
at a federal level. So her education of just, you know what? There was a little bit more than just the traffic going in and out of there. There were these little girls that she was worried about, mm-hmm. you know.
And labor trafficking might be even harder to spot, I suppose, because mm-hmm. it may look perfectly normal.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of labor camps in Oregon. There's roughly 300 labor camps in Oregon that are registered, and then there's probably 2 to 3 times as many that are unregistered in the state of Oregon. So if they're unregistered labor camps, you know something's going wrong there. And those are the ones that are very well hidden out in the forests, hidden where you're not going to necessarily see it or notice it.
Well, bottom line, I guess, is that even though it's hard and a little slippery to get our hands on, it still is basically present-day human slavery.
That's all it is.
Well, Keith, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Detective Keith Bickford of the Multnomah County Human Trafficking Task Force. And that's the Human Beat for this month. Thanks for listening. I'm Roger Rocca.